Well, good morning. My name's Bruce. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bruce.
My sobriety date is November 23rd, 1999. And November 23rd, 1999, I was less than sure whether I wanted to live or I wanted to die. And thankfully, I decided that I wanted to live. Enough that I was willing to go to a meeting. I guess I want to begin by just saying how grateful I am for this room. You know, there is a lot of sobriety that has passed through this room, and one of the I think unique experiences AA has given me, and maybe it's given you, is an ability to appreciate the people that have come before. And, you know, for me, it's like in those cups. And some of us that are sitting at this table remember my sponsor, Chuck, who, this guy, he was smaller than me, but he was tough. You know, he had spent 3 years in a Texas prison. And he somehow got out of that, became a counselor, did a lot of great things with his life, but he had this way of talking to me that once he said something, I didn't forget it, you know, that he had a way of just kind of getting to me. And a theme that I want to begin my talk, you know, with is some words out of his mouth as we were sitting, you know, this was... And he said it more than once, you know, in meetings. It's going to probably be it might be a little disruptive theme, you know. I like kind of being disruptive. So, what he would say is, guilt is the belief that we make mistakes, and shame is the belief that we are a mistake. So I'm going to say that again. Guilt is the belief that we make mistakes. Shame is the belief that we are a mistake. So, you can have your own opinion about AA in a lot of different areas. A lot of times when I hear people share, I don't think they're conscious of it, but they kind of describe themselves as kind of bad people trying to get good, right? You know, and I certainly went through that phase where I was convinced I was a bad person and maybe you could help me get good. Then there's, I think, probably the predominant belief at the time of the writing of the big book, which is that we're sick people trying to get well, kind of the whole disease concept, which I think still has a lot of, you know, very good validity. But for me personally, where I am, and I think it's helpful, is I believe that we're wounded people learning to heal. And that when we take the attitude of, and I believe what AA really is a bunch of wounded people, you know, that are becoming healers. And that we're discovering that the best way to heal is to recognize that our wounds, the big book's got this crazy idea that our past is going to be our greatest asset. How can that be? How can I look at all the things that I've done that I may feel like are, you know, shameful, or things that I really wish I could do differently? And how can I then begin to have an experience of transforming those into things that I now see as my greatest assets. And I think what unites us is our wounds. And then what encourages us and inspires us is our healing. And I like to think of meetings kind of like, you go in and, you know, my candle may not be lit, you know, but yours is. And I learn, you know, that I can go, you know, light my candle from yours. And that's a powerful experience. It helps you be okay with the fact that my candle may not be lit today. That's okay. But yours is. And so I can get something I need from you. So, with that is kind of a starting point. Another way of thinking about, is what I hope most of you guys have experienced, which is we will love you until you learn to love yourself. You know, that there is, in this room today, right now, there is love. And that even if you feel like I don't know how to express that, I can experience that. And somehow, as I learn to experience that, I become a container of it, and I begin to recognize that I can also give it away. One of the early experiences I had, sitting in this, I can remember where I was. I was sitting over there in that corner. Someone I didn't really know very well started sharing their story. And they had just picked up a year chip. And all of a sudden, something that didn't happen to me happened. A tear, started showing up. And it was like, why am I crying about a person I don't really know who's telling how this worked for them? And it became just a little a little break that said maybe I can actually have a sense of loving somebody. Not because they're giving me something, but because, I really can identify with their journey, and I can really identify with their healing, and I can really have a sense of somehow gaining hope that can also be a part of my own journey, and not in a selfish way, but in just a way that I'm participating in something that I don't really understand and I don't need to understand. I can still participate. I want to also maybe mention a couple of other things before I get into the what it was like part of this discussion. There is something that happens for me in this room very often, which is learning that the way I see things isn't the only way to see things. That, this idea of reframing, that so often what I believe to be true isn't true. And that when I begin to, and the way this happened for me is, and maybe some of you guys can relate to this, Chuck and I would be here pretty much almost every day. This was, and I still believe, my home group is, I live down in Atlanta in Grant Park. My home group meets 7 mornings a week. It's a 7:30 meeting. It's a little earlier. But I love early morning meetings. And I like to start my day trying to get grounded because I have a way of kind of floating away, So, getting grounded in something beyond myself that can kind of help me stay in the harbor is a good way for me to start my day. But what he would do is he really wasn't so much interested in how I was feeling and how I was thinking. He was very interested in what I was doing. And he was helping me to see that what I do really reflects much more honestly what I really believe. And that don't get too wrapped up in what you're thinking right now. Focus on what you're doing. And he had a way of taking whatever was going on in my life, and I would say, this is how I see it, and he would have a way of reframing it. So he taught me how to reframe my life experience. I didn't have to see it the same way that I've been seeing it. I'll talk about, the best I could do when I really walked in these rooms. I had this, my very, well-informed life philosophy was life is just one big shit sandwich. The only difference is the size bite I take. Okay. So, you know, that was not, that's not exactly a very uplifting, you know, way to, you know. So, you know, he knew that I needed help in beginning to see my life differently. I'm going to now get into kind of, you know, what it was like. And I'm going to really break this into before alcohol and then alcohol and then, you know, into some recovery stuff. So I think sometimes I underestimated the problems that I was really experiencing before alcohol. Okay. I want to kind of look like okay, my problem is just alcohol and or the other things that I'm using to run away. There's a reason why I perceived alcohol as a solution when I first started drinking and using. It's because I had a lot of things I wasn't able to really resolve myself. And so I needed a solution because I had a bunch of problems. And, you know, one of the interesting things about the four step is it's got this little phrase that's kind of, you know, it's very subtle, but, you know, it says we need to get down to causes and conditions. Okay? So this is my attempt to try to get down to causes and conditions. So I, long before I discovered alcohol, and, you know, I discovered alcohol when I was 14, 15. Okay? Man, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. I was not this, like, you know, having this, you know, I title this the myth of the happy childhood. I did not have this, you know, idyllic childhood, and it's not because I had terrible parents, and, you know, as I look at it objectively, my life circumstances, you know, I'm not in a war zone, you know, I mean, I'm not going through, but for whatever reason, you know, I have this filter that interprets my life experience a particular way. And, you know, I'm going to identify what I perceive to be some of my underlying belief systems. Okay? And maybe some of these you'll identify with. One, the first one is, I am alone and I don't fit in. So, I'm not that small now, but when I was growing up, man, I was really tiny. I mean, I can remember being listed on the JV basketball roster as being 5'4", 100 pounds, and that was bullshit. I mean, that was like, I was inflating myself, okay? So I was perpetually physically immature. I was also like the youngest in my class, so I felt like, man, I just didn't fit in. And by the way, there was a lot of reinforcement to that too. Most kids are trying to deal with their own sense of not being enough, right? And so one of the easiest ways for me to be, to avoid that is by putting you down. And all of a sudden I get that temporary sense that I'm okay because you're worse. Okay? And I can get pretty good at using that. So I am alone and don't fit in. That sense of there being something missing. You know, some people talk about the donut, right? That was very real for me long before I picked up a drink. This fundamental belief that I am not enough. You know, this idea really that I am a mistake. You know, that I, you know, if you really get to know me, you're going to see that I'm not enough. And I just had this way of interpreting, you know, I was so full, you know, I even though we didn't move around a lot, you know, I was living in Cincinnati in a place that was growing. And so I went to different schools like every year. And so I'm constantly in this place of trying to see if I can fit in. And then I've got all summer to worry about it. And so from third grade to seventh grade, every first day of school, I got sick. you know, and often it was in, you know, I'm throwing up in the classroom. And so it's like, what a great way to really feel, you know, like, what an asshole this kid is, right? And so, you know, so I had this kind of, the anxiety was real and it was self-perpetuating. And then the next thing that I'll mention is I had this belief that I should be self-sufficient and that I don't need to have emotions I don't want. Okay? So, you know, I can still remember not wanting to go to school, period. Okay? And I can still, and I remember this kind of, and I to some degree really wanted to be like my dad. Okay? My dad, I thought of as kind of being this stoic, you know, didn't feel, just persevere. My mom is kind of this emotional, you know, invalid who kind of gets really wound up and then explodes. And I didn't want to be her, so I wanted to be like my dad. So my real belief was that to grow up means to shut down emotions. And to especially shut down the emotions I don't want to feel. And then the next belief is that what's worse about me is also what is most true about me. So, you know, pick the worst thing that I've got, and I had this belief that that's what's really true, and anything that doesn't fit that is kind of, and so what did that, you know, how did I start feeling? I started feeling like if anybody said something positive to me, that, hey, Bruce, you're doing well, you know, I felt like I was an imposter, that you don't really get this, you know, you don't really see who I am. And I learned that I needed to hide. You know, I wanted to hide a lot of things that, you know, if you saw these things, and, you know, frankly, I hated high expectations. You know, if you expected things of me, then I felt all this pressure. And if I fail, then that means you're going to discover that I'm just not good enough and I'm not what I should be. So it also created that what's worst about me is also what is most true about me, is I didn't want to live in the pain of feeling like, you know, all these things that are worse about me are true about me. So guess what? I get really good at denying. I get really good at deception. I get really good at being dishonest. You know, one of the definitions I heard in this room about honesty that has stuck with me is honesty is the absence of the intent to deceive. If you really start dissecting that, that's hard. Because, you know, I've done a lot of, I've done a lot of selling in my life, you know, and, you know, one of the ways, you know, I think of myself as kind of an outcome junkie. You know, I want particular outcomes in my life. And this program has taught me that instead of having this fidelity to wanting to get something outcome-wise, that I can begin to experience how to have a fidelity to actions, spiritual principles, that then allow me to trust what the outcomes are going to be. But when you really believe, you know, that you're not enough, I was trying to create all these overcompensations so that I could experience enough things on the outside that could fix what was going on in the inside. And then I had this belief that you can give me what I can't give myself. I don't feel okay, but if you feel okay about me, then somehow I can at least temporarily feel okay about myself. So I'm becoming this kind of people pleaser, you know, that wants to give away something to get something back from you, but I'm giving you all this power. I'm giving you tremendous power because if you don't see me the way I want to be seen, then man, I'm in trouble. Right? So, you know, this, and I could go on, but that's probably enough. It's a mistake for me to believe that the only problem I've got here is drinking and using. Because I'm walking in with a set of beliefs that is, you know, that's hard to live with. Now, the way I see recovery, and the way I see, a lot of this is I've got this part of me that's trying to manage better. You know, I want to generate all these outcomes. I've got this other part of me that when that manager part of me can't seem to get what it wants, it wants to run away. And it's pretty good at running away. And both of those parts are trying to hide me from these things I don't want to feel. This sense that I'm not enough. This sense of being kind of exiled, you know, putting all these things in a closet and trying not to experience them. So, you know, as I try to manage my life better to protect me from feeling that I am a mistake, that doesn't work. And so when the feelings get too close, what I was using when I was a kid before I discovered alcohol, I was using cynicism. I was good at being cynical. You know, I could just, I was good at tearing stuff down. I used cynicism, anger, blame, at you to avoid feeling that hate for myself and to experience myself as a mistake. I also got good at distracting myself from how I feel with either good things or bad things. So I developed some skills, some good skills. I was pretty, interested in a lot of areas, and I got good at things because I wanted outcomes, and those outcomes I look at it as great benefits to me now that, I developed some skills. So now, what happens? So I'm in high school. I am a nerd, basically, right? I got a briefcase. I carry a briefcase along with me. Got a bunch of books in it. I'm trying to hide behind this kind of intellectual superiority that makes me okay. And, I've also got this strong rebel part that says, you don't like me. My nickname when I was in high school was Mugger. And again, I'm this really little kid, right? But, I get into a lot of fights. I get into a lot of, I'm not going to let you push me around. And so I've kind of got this war going on. And I don't still have this sense of fitting in. But then I discover that when I get wasted, all of this noise in my head goes away. And I feel a part of something bigger than myself. And I actually feel accepted by you instead of feeling like I'm all, distanced from you. And I'm getting some reinforcement too. Like, hey man, that was fun. So the first time I really, get wasted, my parents are out of town. We invite a bunch of people over. Somebody punches a hole in the wall, which isn't going to be good for me, I get completely wasted. I am sick. Next morning, I'm hungover. And the first thing in my mind, is, when can I do this again? I am so anxious to do this again. So my point in some of this is I needed a solution. And, a way to think about this is instead of me saying, my alcoholism is this terrible thing that had it not happened, my life would be panacea. Another way to look at it is I kind of needed a solution, man. And, this kind of worked till it stopped working. Okay? And that's a way I'm pretty big for me right now on trying to avoid self-condemnation and self-hate. And I really want to begin to embrace who I am instead of trying to erase who I am. So anyway, after alcohol, this is also when I discovered alcohol, this is really when I began to really distance myself further and further from any kind of God or whatever. I become very, don't tell me about God. There's this rebel part that is tired of being the good little boy, because the good little boy is still 5'4", okay? And I wanted to be 6'3". I spent all this money on, you know, I'm working, you know, as a, you know, cutting grass and doing all these things so that I can get enough money to buy, you know, important things like Grow Man Grow, okay? You know, so Grow Man Grow is going to be my life ticket to getting 6'3". And if I'm 6'3", I can get a college scholarship and play basketball and all these other idealized ideas I have. So I'm pissed at God. You know, why do you give me this, you know, this little weak body that I don't want? Okay? Why do I have, you know, fill in the blank? So I began, you know, to really distance myself from God because the only relationships I understood were conditional relationships. I give you this and then you give me this back. Everything's a transaction. You give me this. So this relationship with God, it doesn't seem to be working because I'm trying to be the good little boy, but I'm not getting back what I want, so the hell with that. And that was a long, long time, you know, distance to the point that, you know, I can remember very vividly early in sobriety, walking into a meeting and you guys started talking about God. Oh my God. And so I then got up on my soapbox and was very clear that there is no God and you can't prove that there's a God and blah, 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 blah. And then I walked out dramatically, right? You know. And I had gotten a DUI, so, you know, I couldn't drive. And as I was walking back to my apartment, I had this experience of, Bruce, you are essentially a professional cynic. All you know how to do is tear down. And you got nothing to live, you know, you got nothing. So why don't you begin to think about this differently? And, you know, what helped me with that was, you know, this, the phrase that you hear in the rooms, I believe that you believe, you know, and if I want what you have, I'll do what you've done. And somehow that was enough to get me, I didn't believe, but I believe that you believed, and so I'm willing to do what you've done, and that was enough for me to get started. But that rebel part of me got worse and worse, you know, as I started drinking. So it's not like the drink was not the solution, honestly, to that problem. It got bigger and bigger and bigger. And the deception of myself and others that I talked about previously got bigger and bigger and bigger, you know, the more I drank and the more I used. And then this desire to get wasted and to run away, really, from who I thought I was, that got bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, it was not getting smaller. And I really began to embrace the idea that I do not care. You know, you can say whatever you want to say to me. I do not care. And I disengaged from listening and from having an attention to what others, you know, because I really just got isolated, you know, and my world as I drank and used got smaller and smaller and smaller. You know, I drank because I wanted to feel connected and feel a sense of belonging. And yet the only time I really felt comfortable when it was I was alone and I could drink and use the way that I wanted to, you know. So, you know, that this gets back to, I believe the most important truths for me are paradoxes. This may not be true for you, but, you know, we have the paradox of one is too many and 1,000 is not enough. You know, that's very true for me. We have the paradox that I certainly see myself kind of as an egomaniac with an inferiority complex, right? And then we have kind of the essence of recovery, which is I keep what I have by giving it away. So, you know, to me, the most important truths are paradoxes. And that, if nothing else, should help me to keep, you know, what I think is really important for me, which is a beginner's mind. That, you know, I don't know nearly as much as I think I know. You know, in fact, something that I was going to use, I forgot to say, as kind of an opening here. This I find to be incredibly useful. It's a Mark Twain quote. What gets us into trouble is not what we don't know, it's what we know for sure that just ain't so. I'll read that again. What gets us into trouble is not what we don't know, it's what we know for sure that just ain't so. And, you know, what I've discovered, it may not be true for you, but what I've discovered is what we know for sure very, very often was established so early in my life that I had no way of critically examining whether it was true or not. You know, is it some of those things that I'm talking about that I was believing in the depths of my heart were ways I had of coping with my life that I discovered when I'm 3 or 4 years old. Okay, maybe 5 or 6. Now, did I ever re-examine those? No. Those are just like, those are the operating system. You know, that operating system is kind of locked in. And so the most fundamental things that I believe about myself are being created in me in a time when I am least able to critically examine them. And so part of, you know, recovery to me is about waking up to all these things that I've been unconscious of, that I've been doing, and now gaining some level of consciousness about it. So anyway, now when I get into, you know, so some other things, you know, this idea of not caring and apathy, I become even, as you can probably tell from my philosophy about the shit sandwich, my negativity and my unexamined fears are growing and growing and growing. Okay, so this restless, irritable, and discontent that I experienced before alcohol, man, it is ramping up big time. And for me, I become suicidal. You know, I carry around a razor blade because I like the feeling of knowing that I can cut and not be around if I want to. That seems like good, you know, a good solution to me. Carry a razor blade so that I've got that power to kill myself whenever I feel like I need to. And you know, I check myself into a mental hospital because I don't think I got an alcohol problem, but I know I got some kind of problem. But once I check myself into a mental institution, my big problem becomes I want to get the hell out of here. And I'll tell you whatever you want to hear so that I'm out of here, because I don't want to be here. So what happened to me, I'm going to talk about multiple bottoms, but my first bottom is that I plan to quit work. I got this big plan. I got a great solution, man. I'm gonna quit work. I'm gonna move to the coast. I got an apartment I found over a bar. And I the way for me to avoid a DUI is to be, you know, living right above the bar. What a perfect solution. So, you know, I go into my boss and say, you know, I'm pretty excited about my solution. And she knows me pretty well. And she just, you know, she says, dude, when are you going to wake up? When are you going to face the, you know, what you're running away from? And there was enough of an opening there that I was willing to go, you know, get into treatment. And, you know, I needed to stay in a halfway house for a period of time, then a three-quarter way house for a period of time. But what I really wanted to do at that point, I accepted that I was an alcoholic and I accepted that I couldn't use, but I really didn't want to do all this other stuff. And I really wanted to just kind of, I'm pretty good at compartmentalizing. Okay, so, okay, yeah, I won't drink and I won't use. But, you know, as I'm in my three-quarter way house, you know, my ex-wife who worked at the same place, you know, she starts getting kind of interested in me, or at least I think so. And so all of a sudden this other human being is kind of interested in me. And so, man, I can't deny that. And so I want to get, you know, I just want to jump into being normal. Okay. I've had my abnormal. Now I can go be normal. And I mean, it wasn't quite this way, but you know, she never understood the alcoholism, and I never really was willing to make the stand for who I was and what I needed. And so for a long period of time, you know, got married, three kids, you know, life goes on, and I'm not drinking, but I'm getting more and more and more angry. I mean, that's all I got. You know, I got this part of me that's trying to manage better. I got this part of me that is trying to run away when managing doesn't work. And the only way I know how to run away is anger. So I'm almost impossible to live with. So Thanksgiving Day, 1999, you know, I get kicked out of the house. Not because I'm drinking, but because I'm so angry. And I'm not sure whether, like I said earlier, whether I want to live or I want to die. And I decided, I went back to the NABA clubhouse where I got sober originally, and I decided that I found a 7:30 a.m., they call it the early morning study group, you know, that Kevin actually knows. And man, I got into it. I jumped in the pool. I got a sponsor. I did the steps. We had a meeting before the meeting, you know, and so people were there, you know, 6:15, you know, 6:15, you know, you take on responsibility to make coffee, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's a meeting after the meeting if you need that, right? So there's a way to really embrace this thing. And that brings me kind of to what it's like now. And I'm not going to say that what it's like now is without challenge, because there's a lot of challenge. You know, I've been sober a while. During sobriety, I got divorced. Okay, that was a difficult divorce. My ex-wife. Wanted the best financial settlement she could get, and she, you know, did a pretty good job of denying access to the kids. And so, you know, that was a really hard time. I'm now remarried, have been, you know, remarried now for 13 years. In that marriage, her son, had a lot of addiction issues. He died, you know, 2 years ago. We have responsibility. We're attempting, you know, pretty imperfectly to raise a 15-year-old, you know. So there's, you know, there's some challenge here, man. But I am excited about my life, and I am grateful for my life, and I am full of hope for my life and for your life. Different phrases mean things to me at different times. What's been driving me really for quite a while is this little phrase. It's a title of one of the Asbill Seasets, from painkiller to pain healer. And so my belief is that we get out of our comfort zone. Getting out of my comfort zone is, first of all, not easy. But when I get out of my comfort zone and I confront my pain, there is then this path through the steps to endless, really, new possibilities. But I don't get there if I don't confront my pain. So I also am, you know, when I'm struggling, one of the best things for me to do is to get out of me and get into you. So this sense of contributing and not feeling like I'm in deficit. You know, when I feel like I'm in deficit, I'm probably going back to that old idea. But when I begin to contribute, I find that connection. And I find a sense that my life, instead of getting smaller and smaller, is getting larger and larger. And you guys taught me that. None of this is anything I've come up with. How do I respond to being disturbed? Okay, that's an important question. How do I respond to being disturbed? You know, I love the Viktor Frankl. You know, there's this, you know, our truest freedom is in how we decide that little moment between stimulus and response, and that's where we discover true freedom. You know, the book in 552 talks about true freedom is when I want to do what I ought to do. You know, and when I begin to discover that this is an inside job and it's not about you, you know, I may think it's all about you, but it's really about what am I doing in that little moment between stimulus and response, and how can I begin to experience that, you know, what the 11-step prayer talks about, that we can be an instrument or a container. I'm not a creator, you know. I'm an instrument or I'm a container of something larger than myself. And the way I look at it, at least, is there is implanted in each one of us a goodness. And when I am willing to be a container and an expressor of that goodness, not from me, but from a power greater than me, then I get this sense of wholeness that comes. So this idea of self-examination and how to respond to my disturbance, this experience that I really have of going from being in bondage to freedom, and the idea that when I am struggling, I'm interested in keeping this beginner's mind that is, what is this trying to teach me? What am I supposed to be learning here? And where am I deceived? And I can tell you, self-deception and deception are not things that have any ceiling. Okay, there's always more that I can be learning. So I am going to end my talk with what I perceive to be full of truth for me. It's the final paragraphs of Keys to the Kingdom. It's one of the most beautiful writings to me. The big book is full of great writings, 12 and 12. This actually is coming from a story. The person who kind of was one of the founders of AA in Chicago. But I love the way she expresses this. AA is not a plan for recovery that can be finished and done with. It is a way of life. And the challenge contained in its principles is great enough to keep any human being striving for as long as he lives. We do not, cannot, outgrow this plan. As arrested alcoholics, we must have a program for living that allows for limitless expansion. Keeping one foot in front of the other is essential for maintaining our arrestment. Others may idle in a retrogressive groove without too much danger, but retrogression can spell death for us. However, this isn't as rough as it sounds, as we do become grateful for the necessity that makes us toe the line. And we find that we are compensated for a consistent effort by countless dividends we receive. Every one of those words feels true to me. A complete change takes place in our approach to life. Where we used to run from responsibility, we find ourselves accepting it with gratitude that we can successfully shoulder it. Instead of wanting to escape some perplexing problem, we experience the thrill of challenge in the opportunity it affords for another application of AA techniques, and we find ourselves tackling it with surprising vigor. I have had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments, because that is life, but also I have known a great deal of joy and peace that is the handmaiden of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship, for to these people I am truly related, first through mutual pain and despair,
and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experience with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love, without strings, without obligations, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness with the awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach. That ache is gone and never need return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys of the kingdom. So that's all I got. Thank you, guys.